With Roger. Roger was preaching in Greenwood, Indiana, when Betsy and I lived here from 86 to 93 and worked with the 25th Street Group. He's about a year older than me. I don't let you argue about which of us looks older, but just good to be with him. We spent a good bit of time together back in those days, and gospel meetings especially, and just good to have him. We haven't spent a lot of time together in a year since then. He went to Kansas City from there, and been in southern Indiana, so it's good back to in Indiana. As he said, we've been able to spend a little time appreciating some of the work that some men did in this part of the country, in southern Indiana in the early 1800s. So that's been enjoyable and encouraging. Our mind's about thinking about Steve, and just surprised as you when I got up today to read the text from Betsy and the email, and hoping that he has a good recovery. A couple of fellows I'd like for you to pray about. Wilson Copeland, JD's father, has been in China for about 3 weeks, has another week or so, I think, and has been preaching there, working there, so we'll be praying for him. And Brownlee Reeves, that you got to meet him. He and Nancy are leaving this afternoon or this evening, going to Newcastle, England, to work with the group there for about 6 weeks. He worked with them last year for about 2 months or so. And so looking forward to going back there. So remember them, please. In the 1890s, there was a fellow by the name of Charles Sheldon. He was a preacher in Topeka, Kansas. He did a series of lessons entitled In His Steps. Toward the end of that, there were articles in a magazine. Those lessons and the stories of those lessons were published in a magazine and eventually compiled into a book entitled In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? Mr. Sheldon was an interesting fellow. He's a prominent figure in the social gospel movement, actually, and he was more concerned about making things better in this world than he was really redemption and salvation from sin. Some good ideas and some good-hearted intentions, although sometimes perhaps a little misguided. He wanted to build the kingdom of the earth, the kingdom of the Lord here on earth, by applying these Christian principles to society's problems. He's really concerned about equity or equality and prohibition. He had something to do in 1920 with the 18th Amendment being passed, was prohibited the production, the sale, and the transportation of any alcoholic beverages, repealed in 1933. He wrote an article in 1918 speaking about this plea of his, that the question of what would Jesus do would be a very practical question. And let me say here, as I will say again, it's a wonderful question. And he said in this article, and I quote, "This is the only creed that will finally redeem the world. Love to God supremely, love to brother man as to oneself. This is the only creed that will put an end to human selfishness and establish universal righteousness. Why don't the statesmen and the presidents and the premiers and the world adjusters around the peace table look at one another and frankly acknowledge that the only promise of real and lasting and universal peace is to be found in the answer to the question, what would Jesus do? Civilization has stumbled over the cross for 2,000 years. Only when it's ready to kneel in tears of repentance for its sin and rise to carry that cross on its repentant heart will the world know the peace and happiness it is now losing because it has never yet accepted the Christ of God, but only the Christianity of man." There are some good things and good thoughts that Mr. Sheldon had in that article, in writing that article. But his hope of establishing universal righteousness on this earth is very misguided, not going to happen. Never was predicted to happen. God is hoping to reform individual lives and turn us to His righteousness. There'll never be a total end of human selfishness in this world. Sadly enough, we should not anticipate that. But hopefully one by one, people will come to know Jesus Christ. Yes, we could absolutely wish that our president and others would sit around the peace table and would each look at each other and ask the question, what would Jesus do? I am fairly certain that the leaders in Iran are not going to ask that question. It's a great question. Mr. Sheldon was more concerned with imitating Christ than finding redemption. The social gospel downplays individual sinfulness and the need for salvation. It's more about the here and now, making this world a better place. We make this world a better place by individually devoting ourselves to doing good when we have opportunity to do good. But on a worldwide scale, we still live in a broken world. Well, that was about 1896. What would Jesus do? He was a youth leader in Holland, Michigan. In 1989, about 100 years later, who decided that she was going to make some bracelets for her students with the letters WWJD stitched across them. And that just took off like wildfire. People caught on. And eventually she was making them, and other people were making them. WWJD started appearing on bracelets and caps and shirts and bumper stickers and coffee mugs. By 1998, Family Christian bookstores were carrying 75 different items with the letters WWJD on them. So it took off and lasted a decade or so. I read where it seems to be making a little bit of a comeback. It's probably another example of a fad. Good idea, good question. As God's people, we understand that in our devotion not to be like the Pharisees, we probably want to be a little careful about, you know, phylacteries on our garments, that little boxes with scriptures in them. So when we're walking around, people can see the boxes. Maybe they rattle a little bit. And the more boxes we have, the more scriptures we know. And that people can say, wow, there's a really religious person. Jesus had some things to say about the Pharisees doing that. We may do some of that. And I'm not going to dismiss all of that. And if you have a bracelet on, you come up to me afterwards today and you have that bracelet on your wrist, I'm going to look at you and say, I hope you're asking that question all the time. It is a great question. I was reading some material about this, and the author of this article wrote, the concept of imitating Christ has a long tradition in church history. Thank you. I'm glad there's some sarcastic people here like me. Really? Are you serious? Maybe about 2,000 years worth? So obviously we've been concerned. Obviously we ought to be very interested in asking the questions so that we can imitate Jesus Christ. We do need to admit something, though. The answers can be subjective. And that's where it gets a little bit challenging in asking questions. A good thing to do, but asking these questions about a lot of different things that are matters of judgment. Again, this is... You would not be surprised by this. I didn't realize there's an evangelical environmental network. It's going back to 2002. They had an ad campaign, and this was started by a preacher in a denomination. And the slogan of the article was, "What would Jesus drive? BMW? I don't know. Ford? Chevrolet? What would he drive?" He said, and I quote, "Jesus wants his followers to drive the least polluting, most efficient vehicle that truly meets their needs. He would definitely be in favor of public transportation." So all my brethren who are driving Teslas are more concerned about what would Jesus do, apparently. You see how silly this gets sometimes, and we're trying to have Jesus, make him a political person, and that's a dangerous thing to do. In fact, in 2011, there's a group called Sojourners, and they had a full-page ad with this slogan, "What would Jesus cut?" Talking about what are you going to cut out of the budget? What were our congressmen working on cutting out? And were they making decisions that they didn't believe were in line with taking care of those who were poor? Some things to think about. They're matters of judgment. You and I don't get up every day and say, well, would Jesus wear this? Would he wear this? Probably not. Who should we marry? Jesus never got married. Where will I go to school? Good questions. Where will I live? How much money should I spend on this? You know, there's not specific answers to that. Would Jesus listen to this music that I'm listening to? Would he sit here? And I tell you, there are times when I'm watching a movie and after Betsy and I have spent 30 minutes looking through Netflix trying to find something worthy to be watched, and we turn it on, the first 10 minutes we go, okay, no. And I have moments where I can just see Jesus sitting next to me and go, yeah, Lee, you probably ought to turn that off. I'm not sure you've been watching it in the first place. But I don't know. It just becomes so subjective in asking those questions. Well, let's get more down to the brass tacks of really applying what I think is a good question. So this theme that we're looking at this year is a year with Jesus. We're studying the life of Jesus this quarter. The next quarter is about miracles, and the quarter after that is the teaching of Jesus. This will be hard, this lesson today and this quarter, for me at least, to see the not a real difference between his life, what he did, versus what he taught. Because you can't disconnect those, obviously. But we are going to look at some things about the way he lived. How much time do you spend trying to know about Jesus? It has to be more than today. And these lessons are just to encourage us to, we spend a year with Jesus, so we learn to spend every day with Jesus. How much do you want to know about him? How much do you want to be reminded of him? 2 Peter 3:16, verse 18 tells us to grow in the knowledge of him. Well, that can be the knowledge he's revealed or the knowledge about him. And Peter spent a good bit of time reminding his readers, I'm reminding you of things you already know. I love the old story. Tell the old story, we sing. So much of this we know, we may have forgotten, we don't emphasize it at times. And our goal this quarter is to emphasize some things about the life of Jesus. You know, how much time do you spend trying to get to know somebody you love deeply and admire and respect? I mean, there ought to be Jesus, and anybody else shouldn't even be in the same universe on that list. Yes, we want to know our spouse, our children. We like to know our coaches, our athletes, our musicians, others. It's interesting to study about their life. You find out something about them and you don't admire them as much. In some cases, you might. But the fact of it is, we love to do that. We like to listen to blogs or read blogs or listen to YouTube videos and know something about people that we admire. The invitation for all of us is to grow in our love and our admiration and our respect for Jesus. There's nobody like him. And let's put him, elevate him, sanctify him in our hearts, set him first in our hearts to focus on him. What would Jesus do? Well, you can't answer that question if you don't know what he did. Because it does become then a very subjective question. But if I really focus on what he did, then I can answer the question of what would he do when I'm looking at my own decisions. The only way we can know. And the only way you can know this is if you read the Gospels. It's our source of knowing who Jesus is. JD and I sat down a couple weeks ago and we were going through this and kind of working through what lessons we're going to preach this quarter. And I looked at him and said, his next lesson is going to be about the 12-year-old Jesus up to the point he's 30 years old. And there's enough in there. There's some good things to talk about the character of Jesus, the kind of life that he lived during those 12 to 13 years old before he began his 3.5-year work of preaching the gospel. And so he's going to do that. And I said, are you going to include the fact that he spent a few years in India? And he laughed because he'd heard that too. Yeah, you can read some folks that will tell you that Jesus evidently, according to his teaching, would have spent some time in India. This is when we lose our minds, you know. We come up with things that we just aren't there. So thankfully, we're going to be embedded in the New Testament, in the Gospels. to know about Jesus. And that doesn't mean the epistles don't tell us a lot about the character of Jesus. They certainly do. Jesus hasn't asked you and me to do anything that he didn't do. No, I know we can't do miracles. But when it comes to his character, he hasn't asked us to live up to a standard that he didn't himself live up to. Jesus told the disciples when he was reproving the Pharisees, he said, "Do as they say, but not as they do." Jesus is not that person. We can do as he said because we're doing as he did. He modeled for us everything he instructs us to do and to be. He is absolutely the truest model of godly behavior ever. And so we look to him. We have been called to imitate Jesus. Several passages I want you to consider with me. In Ephesians 5, 1 and 2, be imitators, followers. We get our English word mimic from the Greek word translated follower or imitators. Mimic Jesus. Be imitators of God. Therefore, as dearly loved, I'll get it right, man, dearly loved children. I see the word beloved in there because of the other translations. And walk in love as Christ also loved us. You see, we walk with him. We walk in his steps, as we're going to be emphasizing. I want to imitate him. I want to follow him. I want to mimic him. And the only way I can do that is to know him. And that's what we're going to encourage each other to think carefully about, at least for this quarter. Luke 9:23, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. The word follow here is an interesting word. It means to be on the same road, really. To be on the same path, be on the same way, going the same direction, same way. And it's with us. Jesus wants us next to him, didn't want us behind him, dragging us or in front of him, trying to lead him. He's right there next to him, but he is telling us this is the way we're going to walk, and he wants us to walk with him. It's a great picture. There are two roads, and there are folks walking on a road in which they have, like Jesus said, call him Lord, but not doing the things that he said, and that's not the path we want to be on. So we want to know what he did say and how he did live, so we can know we're walking along step by step with him. We're accompanying him. There'll be a lesson, I'm fairly certain, on the example of John 13 when Jesus washed the feet of the disciples. He said, "I have said to them, after washing their feet, after laying aside, after taking up a towel, taking a bowl, and went around and washed their feet, setting an example. I've set an example, a pattern, an exhibit. This is exhibit A." You ever have something, somebody said, "Well, this is exhibit A. This is what I want this to look like." And Jesus is that exhibit A for us. He is the example or the pattern. God's a God of patterns, by the way, a God of examples, of giving us examples of how we should live, that you should do as I have done for you. Then our reading today in 1 Peter 2:21, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." And that's probably an uncomfortable a little bit when you think about it. It is learning to suffer. It's learning to live under a government that's oppressive, doing things we don't agree with. It is working for a boss that is not easy to work for. He even follows this in 1 Peter 3. It's being married to someone who's not necessarily easy to be married to. This talks about the woman married to an unbelieving husband, and her character, and her character is to be chaste and respectful, and that's the character of Jesus. But in all of that, we may suffer because we love the Lord and we put him first, and other people around us, a husband may not treat us well in return, a government, a boss, learn to suffer. And when we're reviled, don't turn right around and revile in return. Those are high callings of the character of Jesus that we're to follow in. 1 John 2 and verse 6, whoever claims to live in Him must walk as Jesus did, as we've already seen. Paul makes this statement, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. Yeah, that seemed a little strange for us to think, would I ever say that to anybody? Paul was as an apostle in Philippians 4:9. He said this about himself, the things which to the Philippians which you have learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. It's a good thing to follow the example of Paul. But it is inferred in this statement, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ, that they would recognize what Jesus did. So when they looked at Paul, they're thinking, well, that's just the way Jesus would have done things. That's the way he lived. That's the way he thought. So it's not about Paul. It's still about Jesus when he asked them to do that. What did Jesus do? The life of Jesus from his birth to his ascension. So the next 15 minutes, I'm going to talk about everything he did from his birth to his ascension. Jesus talked about the birth of Jesus in his first lesson a couple of weeks ago. Here's some things we're going to talk about, and this is just getting you thinking about it. Feel free to come to me or JD and say, here's one maybe that I'd like to hear about. And again, it's not so much about the teaching as it is about his example. What do we learn about that 12-year-old Jesus? What do we learn about the 30-year-old Jesus? What can we learn and know about him during that 18 years? There are some things to be learned, and that's going to be JD's lesson. How did he handle temptation? That's going to be one of mine. How did Jesus handle difficult people? Don't have any difficult people in your life? Don't smile too big, especially next to the one you're, anyway. You know, some days are difficult, some days are challenging. We're not always everything we ought to be. How did Jesus deal with the apostles? How did he work with the apostles? I have a book Bill Hall gave me years ago, recommended, called The Training of the Twelve by last name of Bruce. And it's very challenging reading. And I may pick it up and read it again. I don't have too many books that Bill Hall suggested. But it's really about the look of Jesus and his interaction with the apostles and training them. It would be a good training exercise, good for preachers, for elders. You know, how do I help somebody else become the person I want them to be? What did he do with the apostles? How did he handle them in the good situations and the disappointing situations? Those are some lessons we're going to look at. How did he deal with false teachers? How did he deal with the Sadducees and the Pharisees? Jesus is a great question asker. We can learn to do that too. What about the significance of the transfiguration on the mountain? That'll be a lesson. How did he handle personal attacks on his character? Shouldn't we handle them the same way? How did he interact? Just his interaction with people. I would say to you that Jesus was the greatest people person that's ever lived. And I know that every one of us has to rise up to that level, but it would be good for us to become better at our being able to interact with others, so that the opportunities might open up for us to teach, even when we're tired and thirsty and really don't want to talk to anybody. Like Jesus at a well, tired and thirsty, and a woman comes out and he talks to her. And just that interaction itself got that going. She's a Samaritan. You're talking to me. The apostles came back and shocked that he's even talking to a woman. Don't do that. Why not? Because of the prejudices and the traditions of men. And he talked to her, and he led her to know who he was. It's one of the few times Jesus ever told anybody he was the Messiah. And she went in the city. Anyway, I'm about ready to preach that. But it's a great example of his interacting with people, finding opportunities to talk about eternal things. There's a little booklet that's come out, and I'm planning to get it. It is John Babcock, some of you know, one of the elders at Avon, that his son-in-law married to their daughter Chelsea, very affluent Hispanic, Spanish, preached in California. I believe he's in Florida now. But anyways, written a little book on how to open up conversations, just daily conversation with our people, and how to lead those into spiritual things. I look forward to it. Jesus was excellent at that. And I imagine that Brother Flores has taken some of that idea. Anyway, that's just some of the things we're going to talk about. How do you treat women? Jesus opened up a whole new world in the minds of the apostles in the way he interacted with women. J.D. mentioned this one. What part did hospitality play in the life of Jesus? I'm not sure. He didn't have a house and invite people to his house, but he was really good at accepting offers of hospitality. And there are some days that Jesus might have been the last person you wanted to invite, because you might end up being reproved before he left the house, especially if you said something that needed to be corrected. But he ate with tax collectors and sinners and harlots. I'm going to talk about that one. That'll be mine, at least part of that will be. What made him happy? Years ago, I did a lesson on, was Jesus a happy person? That wasn't the whole lesson. I was talking about happiness and our misguided hopes of being happy and what happiness is and isn't from a biblical perspective, Ecclesiastes. But was he happy? And there was an older preacher there came up to me and said, I don't know if he's happy or not, but he seemed to be really comfortable in his own skin. That kind of stuck with me. Was he sad, grieved, angry? Did he experience any of those things? When should we be angry? What should make us sad? What should grieve us? I saw this and I liked it. When someone says, what would Jesus do? Remember, flipping over tables and chasing people with a whip is within the realm of possibilities. You know, this really nice Jesus, you know, that would never do anything like that. Are there times to kind of get upset at some of the foolishness in religion in this world? Absolutely. When the church has been turned into a social, entertaining, sports-minded organization, it's obviously time to say we need to flip some tables. Anyway, what can we learn from Jesus during the 40 days he spent with the apostles after his death and resurrection? That's mine. I told J.D., he said, that's going to be the last one, and I want that one. And I'll tell you why I want it. Because I understand us wrestling and struggling with things that have happened to us. How did Jesus handle the trauma of the cross? And let's all agree about something, and I'll stop because I don't want to start preaching it. The cross was as traumatic an event and experience that anybody's ever gone through. And it will be helpful and encouraging to think about how Jesus responded to that after he was resurrected from the grave. And I believe that he's calling us to respond in just such a way. Well, thank you for listening to that. That's the introduction to all of this. And so we'll begin building on these lessons and let you know what we're planning to do for the next quarter. Again, if you see some things aren't in there, you want to suggest, I'm not sure we can get to all of those. But J.D. and I will work through those, and I look forward to preaching those. And again, I know three of them at least, and it's already about the third week in April, so that means I've got about 2.5 months left to preach some of these things. So I look forward to sharing with you, engaging you in these lessons. Let me tell you something else Jesus did. He was baptized. You know that. Maybe you didn't know that. He was baptized. Now you do a study of that and you understand it wasn't to be forgiven of his sins. He never sinned. It wasn't to be added to his church. That wasn't what was going to happen. He's the head of his church. When he came to John, John was just ready to say, no, this is just wrong. I ought to be being baptized by you, not me baptizing you. And Jesus turned to him and said, let's fulfill all righteousness. Interesting statement. To me, I simply said, let's do what my Father wants me to do. Let's do what's right. And Jesus gave us an example. And I believe he was immersed, by the way. Saw a picture, movie one time about Jesus, and he was standing there in the water. John the Baptist took some water. I mean, they're already down in the water. The water's up to here, okay? You've already got this wet. And he reached down the hand, takes some water, and sprinkles on Jesus' head. You know, come on. So he immersed him. He comes up out of the water. Remember what happened? And perhaps this was to convince John that this is him even more. Spirit descends upon him in the form of a dove, and a voice from heaven says, this is my Son in whom I am well pleased. And John the Baptist said, this is him. There may be some parallel to the fact that when you and I are immersed, based on our faith in Jesus, putting our trust in him and what he's done for us to forgive us, that we repent of our sins and intend to make changes in our life. We're immersed. We come up out of the water. Every sin we've ever committed washed away. We are clean. God has purified us. It's at that point that God is saying, now you're my child. I understand Jesus was already the Son of the Father before that. So that's not a perfect parallel, but for me and you, we're not a son of God. We're not a child of God. God could not speak from heaven. And the promise of the Holy Spirit in Acts 2 and verse 38, that comes to those who are immersed for the remission of their sins. So we urge you today, if you're thinking about that and haven't done that, Jesus said, I did. I was willing to do that. I was willing to be humble myself and let this guy named John the Baptist immerse me and bring me up out of the water. And that's when my Father acknowledged me, and that's when God will acknowledge you and me as being his children. He won't do it audibly, but he'll do it because you know that's what he's promised in Scripture. Can we help you? Let's grow together. Let's live for Jesus. Let's ask the question, what would Jesus do? And be more and more like him. If we can help, will you please come while we stand and while we sing?
Oh, my son.